Hello, Falava. This is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Swiswiki. Coming up.
So I think we are 90% away from closing for all the reserves.
There's still no clear winner on who will govern Solomon Islands. Also, an expat judge in Kiribati could be facing deportation, and
it signifies that this it's not just a strong and valued partnership, it's an enduring partnership.
The US and Pacific Island states reach an agreement on tuna access. As counting wraps up in the Solomon Islands, the Electoral Commission is looking at trialling out-of-constituency voting. With only a handful of seats in the 50-member parliament yet to be officially declared, there is no outright winner. But lobbying to form the country's next government is underway. As of yesterday, the two largest blocs in the winner's circle, Independents and the incumbent Prime Minister Manase Sogavare's Our Party, retired with 12 MPs each. Koroi Hawkins spoke with Chief Electoral Officer Jasper Anisi and asked him how he thought the country's first joint national election went.
So I think we are 90% away from closing for all the results. All the results have come in except for Guadalcanal, only two constituencies, and provincial wards within those two constituencies are still yet to be counted. But hopefully by end of this evening, all results should come out.
And any more challenges, anything? What have been some of the biggest challenges so far, logistics or human error, some of the things that we've been hearing? Just go through some of those, please.
Yeah, there's a few challenges that we've met. There's some mistakes, some errors by our officials, but there are laws and policies that we can use to remedy those kind of things. But there's nothing that can deter an election or something like that.
And the process from here on, once those last polling stations, the counting's through, what happens after that?
So we do verification in terms of checking the numbers, checking the voter turnouts and all these things. And once that is done, then we gazette. We send a notice back to the Attorney General for vetting and gazetting, and then we gazette it. Once it's gazetted, then we send it back to the Governor General and to the Clerk of Parliament, and then the next part starts the formation of government. And that, from that end, our job as election management body, we stop once the gazettes are out.
And the 30-day petition period starts once the gazette is out as well?
That is correct.
For candidates who have lost and are preparing things, do they have ongoing engagement with the commission in terms of preparing those petitions, or how does that work for us, a losing candidate preparing a petition? Is it a separate legal process?
I think all the candidates will have to bring the evidence, because it's either you challenge the process or you challenge the other candidate for bribery. So most petition will be against our process, and we have our, if we know those claims coming in, then we will prepare our evidence to support or our defense in that sense.
We've had so many observer missions here in the country. Have you got any feedback from them so far from different observer missions?
Yes, we have two feedback, one from G7 Plus and Pacific Island Forum. From both reports, verbally discussed with us, the commission, I think they're very impressed about what's being done in these elections, and I think everything is on track. There are a few recommendations that we can build on from there, one such as out-of-constituency voting. But we shelved that for a while, because knowing joint election is a huge task in itself. But now that we've done joint elections, now we will be looking forward in trying to implement out-of-constituency voting to help especially our seasonal workers who've been out of the country working, so that we can provide them that avenue, and also students who are studying during election period, so that they can cast their vote. So that's the next step the commission will be looking after everything. And one more policy that we want to do is to have the continuous registration of electors as we go along.
Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will attend Anzac commemorations in Papua New Guinea. Albanese arrived in the country on Monday, where he met with Prime Minister James Marape. Although Anzac Day is a holiday in Papua New Guinea, ceremonies typically see low public turnouts. Whenau Whanua spoke with our correspondent in PNG, Scott Whitey, about the visit.
Anthony Albanese is in Papua New Guinea. What's the purpose of his trip? We heard that he's going to be there for the Anzac celebration commemorations.
Yes, he's here for the Anzac celebrations, and today they were flown to the Kokoda Trail, one part of the Kokoda Trail, and both prime ministers have begun a short trek along the Kokoda Trail, a symbolic just marking the date and just honoring the soldiers who fell along the Kokoda Trail. So as with other visits by Australian prime ministers and delegations, they usually discuss, you know, ongoing trade, the existing defence pacts trade. So those discussions have been ongoing in one form or other.
And just this week, I think it's just yesterday, a Chinese delegation visited the Chinese foreign minister. It's a bit of a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, Papua New Guinea is of very high interest to the Chinese and other powers, allied powers, especially the U.S. The U.S. already has a defense cooperation agreement. And immediately after the defense cooperation agreement, the prime minister also reached out to China, basically saying that our trade arrangements still stand. So this visit by the Chinese foreign minister comes as no surprise. It just strengthens what the discussions that have been ongoing between China and Papua New Guinea and the trade relations that have been ongoing. China's strategic interest in Papua New Guinea is primarily trade, but there's also a defense interest on the part of China in the Pacific. So Papua New Guinea will always be that key component in whatever discussions that they're having.
And recently we also had those comments from President Biden. It comes just in the lead up to Anzac Day. Has this prompted a lot of anger in Papua New Guinea?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk on Facebook, but I mean, people are taking it very seriously. There's a lot of people who are quite angry with Joe Biden's comments about the cannibal thing. But, you know, Papua New Guinea has always been this butt of jokes where people are, poke fun at the cannibalism and all those perceptions that people have on the outside. Some people are angry with it. Some people are saying, look, it's just U.S. president stating things that are not true. There's others who have come out and said that the President Biden should apologize through the U.S. embassy. So it's the ordinary person going about his business, doing his thing. So it's affected a lot more people on social media.
Marape mentioned in his response the unexploded bombs. Has that arisen in Marape's meeting with Albanese?
No, I'm not sure that has happened. The Prime Minister has released a statement saying that the U.S. should come and collect its war remains. And that's been in response to the Biden statement that was made. So at the political level, there's talk in between at the diplomatic level. But as I said, the ordinary person on the street has seen it, but hasn't really affected people as much.
Is unexploded ordnances a continuing problem in Papua New Guinea? Does it enter the public discussion much?
Not much. There are instances where a bomb is found, especially there have been instances where bombs, unexploded ordnances have been found in Leh, where I live, and it's been disposed of by the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. But it doesn't filter through the public discourse as much as it used to in the 80s and the 70s when people were concerned about, you know, remnants of World War II. A lot of them are in rural areas. Some people go out and find them deliberately, but it hasn't been a real problem in many, many decades.
Anzac Day, is it how relevant is it for the average Papua New Guinean person?
Yeah, look, it's a day that's important for Papua New Guinea and Australia, but it's also, you see, World War II wasn't a battle that Papua New Guineans on this land actually chose to fight. They were drawn into it, and a lot of young men were drafted into the army to fight. Some were taken as carriers to help the Australian cause. It's important to Australia. I can say that it's important to Australia. And there's a lot of unwritten history that needs to be told. And a lot of the responsibility is on the PNG government side. We need to sit down and write. Our families need to also document who participated in the campaigns, who contributed, so that there's some pride in their participation in the Anzac Day.
Over 50,000 Papua New Guineans, Bougainvillians and Solomon Islanders assisted in the war effort. Meanwhile, an Australian-born judge in Kiribati could well face deportation later this week after a tribunal ruling that he should be removed from his post. The tribunal's report has just been tabled in the Kiribati Parliament and is due to be debated by MPs later this week, the last week of the current Parliament ahead of the general election. Don Wiseman has been following the story and joins me now. Don, the story has dragged on for years. What are the latest developments?
Well, it's been going on for nearly 4 years and has seen the judiciary in Kiribati turned upside down, causing huge backlogs in the court system. For the country was left without judges for quite some time. Now, historically, Kiribati has relied on expat judges. But the man in the gun here, David Lambourne, he is Australian, but he's lived in Kiribati for many years and is married to the opposition leader, Tessie Lambourne.
What does the case centre on?
Well, there were a number of issues that the government raised, but it has largely come down to a civil court case in 2020 that Lambourne heard. After giving his oral decision in that case, he left the country for a judicial conference in Australia before he had delivered his written decision. And as we all know, 2020 was the first year of COVID, and Kiribati shut its doors to nearly everyone, so Lambourne couldn't get back into the country for months. When he did get back, he then faced myriad accusations, was stood down, and attempts were made to deport him. But a ruling heard by the then Chief Justice, New Zealand Judge Bill Hastings, exonerated him from any wrongdoing. An appeal by the government to the Court of Appeal also found in Lambourne's favour. But an incensed Kiribati government then removed all of those judges, making accusations about them in the process. It should be noted that all of those judges are current or former members of the New Zealand judiciary and are held in high regard. Lawyers and judges and agencies around the world representing them condemned the Kiribati government for its actions in relation to the judiciary there. At least some of those judges are seeking legal redress over their removal.
So where did this tribunal come from?
Well, the government set up what it had stressed was an independent tribunal back in May of 2022. But this tribunal suspended its work 2 months later when Lambourne had challenged its existence. It was staffed by a lay magistrate, a legal practitioner, a former public servant and a retired teacher. So one would imagine not a huge amount of legal nous there. It started work again in 2023, but this was again suspended when the High Court issued an interim injunction. And then last month, the government reconfigured the tribunal, and in no time at all, it produced a report which the politicians are shortly to discuss.
What does it say?
Well, it refers to 5 allegations against Lambourne, but it dismissed 3 of these for lack of evidence, and has largely focused on the failure to get a written report out in time to satisfy some. Though it's my understanding there was no untypical delay there and that the COVID disruption was a huge part of it. The tribunal says in its recommendation that the Parliament should consider removing Lambourne from his role as a puny judge in the Kiribati High Court for persistently disregarding the prompt delivery of written judgments, by neglecting to take thorough measures to prevent any misunderstanding about the fundamental role of a judicial officer, and by behaving in a manner that creates the perception of bias. And then the fifth allegation, I said there were five and three got dismissed. The fifth allegation centred on Lambourne bullying a 57-year-old staffer in the judiciary by yelling at him. The tribunal said this was unacceptable, but then hardly unusual in many workplaces around.
You mentioned his wife was the opposition leader. Is this matter related?
Well, it certainly seems to be a factor. Tessie Lambourne was a highly regarded public servant for many years before going into politics, and she chose not to join the party of the president, Tanis Mamau, the Tabuan Kiribati Party, the TKP. So these two have been adversaries ever since.
What can Lambourne expect?
Well, the president's party dominates parliament, and it'll be wanting to eliminate this matter, which is, as we talked about, hung around now for 4 years, and they want to eliminate it ahead of the elections. They're due in a few months. No election date's been set yet. So the parliament could well vote later this week to deport Lambourne, and for that to happen immediately. Lambourne would be able to appeal the findings of the tribunal, but then doing that from outside of the country would be, well, it would be problematic.
A memorandum of understanding has been signed by the United States and the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, allowing US purse seine fleets to fish in the exclusive economic zones of 17 Pacific Island nations. The document ensures continued fishing rights for the fleets in 2024, pending the formal adoption of agreed amendments to the revised South Pacific Tuna Treaty for 2025 onwards. The agreement includes an annual $60 million payment from the US government for the next decade, along with additional funding for economic development and climate change related projects. Tiana Haxton spoke to the Director General of the Pacific Islands FFA, Dr. Manu Tupou-Rusin, to find out more.
It's important to recognise that we've been in this for more than 30 years at the outset. And so the MOU that's being signed at present is to do with access and fees for 2024. And it was to give time for the finalization between our parties on what would be the next tranche of access for the next longer term duration. And so it's been so important to still have this valuable process in place of the Memorandum of Understanding, because it gives us that space and time to sort those longer-term arrangements out.
In the revised treaty package, the US has tripled its payments to $60 million yearly to fish in the Pacific for the next 10 years. What does this deal signify?
I think it signifies that with this increase from $21 million a year to $60 million a year for the next 10 years, so a total package of $600 million, it signifies that this is it's not just a strong and valued partnership, it's an enduring partnership. It also provides an important platform for enhanced cooperation with the United States in many other areas. It's not just about the fishing activities. It's all those important aspects around it to, for example, combat illegal fishing, protect the fishery, to manage and develop the fishery. So we're very excited about this continued work with the United States.
And in addition to that 60 mil, the US government has also agreed to another $10 million payment, specifically for economic development, including climate change related projects. So where will that funding be channeled?
That was a one-off deal, and it is provided for economic development, and for half of it, $5 million to be channeled towards climate action-related activities. And that's divided an equal share to our member countries. And like I said, it's just that one-time arrangement for the $10 million. But as we noted earlier, there is that longer-term arrangement now set in place, which is $60 million a year as the US government's contribution.
And so there will be another signing event later this year. What can you tell us about that?
The current memorandum of understanding that's being signed is just for 2024 access and fees. What will be signed later this year is the longer term package for a set duration of years and multi-year. And it involves the industry's payment for those years in addition to what U.S. government contribution is already, and also the type of access, the number of days that they could access.
And if we could also talk about the U.S. legislation. So the amendments of 2016 that were never fully incorporated into U.S. law, is there a roadmap and timeline for bringing this bill to the House?
I think that would be best targeted to the U.S. on their time frame and opportunity for having that incorporated into their regulatory system. And in terms of those amendments, whilst for even some of our Pacific Island parties, they're still working that through their own system, there's been an understanding between all of the parties and working in good faith that we can continue to provide this access, receive those fees with the intention that those legal changes will be made. So it's such an exciting time.
So on that note then, for our Pacific partners, has the delay posed any challenges?
There have been no challenges. We work off a really good, strong platform with the United States being in this space for us in this partnership for over 30 years.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We farewell our colleague Whenau Whanua. Thank you for all that you've done. From the RNZ Pacific team and myself, Tofa Soifua.